Greetings, race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, John Stark, who serves as president and CEO of the University of Wyoming Foundation. Welcome, John.
Brent, thank you. A pleasure to be with you today.
Well, if I were to map out people who I feel like I know the best in this industry relative to how much I actually know about them, I think you'd be pretty high up there. Where I feel like I know you really well, we've had the opportunity to spend a bunch of time together. And then I was thinking about, like, what is John's actual story? And I've gotten bits and pieces of it, and we've shared it, you know, at various conferences. So I'm excited to learn that selfishly, so I can really get to know you better, but also so we can share your story with the Raise podcast community. And so with that, I'm going to start as we usually do and ask you to tell me a little bit more about your own higher education journey. Take me back to like junior year of high school. Who was that John Stark? What was he into? And what led you to the University of Wyoming?
Well, I tell you, Brent, I appreciate you asking that question, because, you know, in this business, it's all about you better enjoy hearing people's story, and we've all got one. So my story with the university coincides with my relocation to the state of Wyoming. Real quick, my father was in the National Park Service, so that's like being in the military. You move around the country. And when I was 14 years old, we moved from the Boston area to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And I was about to start my sophomore year in high school, and we drove through Laramie, Wyoming, on the way, and my dad said, you know, son, take a good look around. This is where you're going to go to college in a few years. And I just remember taking a good look around. And since you've been here, you know, if you've not been here before, Laramie is a small town in a remote location. But literally, that is how my relationship with this place started. And I always jokingly say that was the best decision my father ever made for me, because true to his word, I came here 3 years later and just had a wonderful experience as an undergraduate student here.
So, John, where did you graduate from high school?
Jackson, Wyoming.
Yeah. And so Boxborough, Massachusetts, if I'm not mistaken.
You got it. That's pretty good, Brent.
Boxborough to Jackson. A lot of people made that move that year, I'm sure.
Yeah, there were lots of people from the, you know, the suburbs of Boston moving to Jackson.
What was that like, being the Boston kid? I don't know if you identified that way, given, you know, maybe the various moves, but that's a big move. And I don't know. I mean, was it an easy transition to high school? Was it hard at that age?
You know, in some ways, it was so easy because the people in Wyoming are so welcoming and kind people. Jackson is a place that attracts people literally from all over the world. And so it was a wonderful place to move at that age. And I can remember the first time I saw the Grand Teton Mountains as we crested this pass north of Jackson, and just thinking, wow, this is going to be our new home. And while I love Boston and New England, Jackson Hole is a pretty special place. So,
and so you applied and attended the University of Wyoming. Tell me about the experience. When you think about favorite memories, key moments, what stands out?
Attended the University of Wyoming started in the fall of 1982. Thought, well, study business, and always had kind of in the back of my mind that law school might be a good move for me. But early on, had a number of friends from the Jackson area that were down here, but I quickly discovered Greek life and joined the Sigma Nu fraternity here. And that was kind of the first sort of life altering big decision that I made at that age, because it did kind of change. It was a big change in my life, and it kind of influenced. Wouldn't have guessed it at the time, but it influenced this career and a lot of the relationships I've built through the years, and gave me everybody at Greek Life was my community, just as football was probably for you, Brent. But everybody, it's so important to find your sense of community when you go to school, and that for me was the my community that opened a lot of doors for me.
And did it help you shape the path to law school, or was that already pretty? I mean, did you have other mentors or people that kind of guided you in that direction?
Yeah, I can't say that the Greek experience necessarily shaped that. I'd had some family friends that were attorneys that kind of helped. Hey, John, you should take a look at this. This would be good for you and your skill set. And certainly there were some faculty members too that encouraged it. And so I thought about that early on in the process of my education and graduated in 4 years, and law school became the next chapter.
And so tell me about law school, and then really the decision to attend and get right back, from what I understand, to Jackson.
So, yeah, I attended the University of Oklahoma College of Law in Norman, and had number. We had lived in Oklahoma earlier when I was a kid, and had some family in that area and some familiarity, and went to Norman kind of, not knowing a soul, which is, I think, always a good experience in terms of the students, and had a wonderful experience. Found Oklahoma to be a lot like Wyoming in many ways. There were not many kids from Wyoming attending that law school. Imagine that. Had a wonderful experience there as well. And then came back, and following 3 years in Norman, I took the Wyoming bar and actually returned to Jackson Hole to practice.
So tell me about that. And also, I have not been to Jackson Hole. I hear amazing things. It's sort of this, like, I don't know, famous place these days. I don't know if it felt that way then, but I got to learn more about just what was life like there then, practicing in that community, and of course, what's it like today?
So Jackson, and this was 1989 to be specific, when I returned as a young lawyer and having had my family live there a number of years, and I was pretty familiar with the community and a lot of the folks in town and families. And so it was probably easier for me to start a law practice there, having a lot of those relationships, and thoroughly enjoyed it. And Jackson is a unique small town, because it's got, it's a resort community. It's got two national parks nearby, in Grand Teton and Yellowstone. And it's got a population. Many of the residents, a very well-educated community. When you go there, you find a lot of your fellow Ivy Leaguers who chosen Jackson to live because of the outdoor amenities and natural beauty. But I had a really what I would say a great experience practicing law too. When you're working in a small firm, you eat what you kill. And so you learn at a early age that your salary is directly commensurate with the amount of time, effort, and energy you put into it. And I had a good several mentors that helped me, in fact, more than several. And I enjoyed it, but I also knew there was something else out there that probably a career in law was not going to be my only profession. Let's just say that.
According to the U.S. Census Bureau, there was something like 5,000 people in Jackson when you moved there. And I think that's doubled or something since then, maybe with city limits plus seasonal. But I mean, small town, your attorney, you're building your practice. Like I think about sometimes, you know, I've engaged with various attorneys through our business and, you know, there's always this phase where like, sometimes they need to do some screen to evaluate, hey, do we have any conflicts of interest across the firm that should be relevant, you know, before we engage, like what is the small town equivalent of that though? Like, I mean, it had to be tricky at times being a member of the community, but also maybe being in between members of the community. And I'm not going to, you know, pry too much, but I just have to ask.
No, that's a very astute point. In a larger community, you wouldn't necessarily run into and represent family members or friends, but in a small town you do. And sometimes the practice of law can be adversarial. And so sometimes you bump into the person on the other side of the case, you know, in the supermarket, and that can make for some, you know, uncomfortable moments. But you just have to always maintain the degree of civility. And had a number of attorneys who, you know, yes, this is serious stuff, but, you know, don't take it too serious and never lose those other folks on the other side of the case are human beings and have families just like you do. And you're there to represent the interests of your client and help solve problems.
Did you stay engaged with the University of Wyoming during that time period, formally or informally?
You know, at first, informally, more, you know, sometimes the College of Law dean might come through town, or there would be an event with the Alumni Association or the athletic programs. And so I became sort of maybe a point person in the community in an unofficial capacity to someone who cared about the university and the experience I had. And there was a nice nucleus of people, like-minded people up in Jackson at that time about the university. And so at first it was unofficial, and then that evolved into more of a official capacity through a board opportunity with the university athletics.
And when did you first have when was the seed planted of, hey, know you got a good thing going in the legal, you know, career you're building in Jackson, but would you ever consider something like this at the university?
You know, I would say there was always something in the back of my mind, even when I was graduating from law school, that at one time I thought, you know, a career in collegiate athletics might be really interesting. But I never really pursued it to any meaningful degree. But through my working with, became acquainted with some folks in the athletic department. In fact, the person who I became acquainted with is still our athletic director today, Tom Berman, who's had an outstanding career in collegiate athletics. And he's the person that kind of probably 6, 7 years into my career, he said, "Hey, you should get involved on our board, our advisory board, and I think you could help represent sort of Jackson and the Teton community and help keep folks engaged in that community with UW." So that's how I really became more engaged with the University of Wyoming.
And then when did you decide to join the team full time?
You know, there were some, I had expressed an interest and we'd had some conversations, Tom Berman and I, he was an associate athletic director at the time. And I said, you know, I might really be interested in pursuing an opportunity if the right one arose. And it turned out when he left to take his first athletic director position at Portland State University, that opportunity did arise. And I threw my hat in the ring, and I think I shocked some people in Jackson and family members when they said, "You're doing what? You're going to pursue this opportunity at the University of Wyoming and maybe leave Jackson?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, I really want to do this."
What did you tell them though? Why do that? I mean, you're living in the Tetons. You've got,
I know it was
your family. I mean, why?
You know, it was one of those things where, again, I had this in the back of my mind while I enjoyed my legal career, in a small town, and my career was evolving. There, you know, less litigation, more transactional. I actually went to work for the county doing the county's civil work, so zoning and planning and things of that nature. But but I thought, you know what? If I stay in Jackson, I'm going to be in private practice, or perhaps I'd be a member of the judiciary, become a judge, or I'll be in governmental practice. And I said, and I'll do that the rest of my working career. And at that time, I just said, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm just not. There's more out there to do and see in this world. And as much as I love my closest thing to a hometown, and I enjoyed the practice of law, I said that I'm not going to box myself in. That's why I really pursued this opportunity.
And you became an associate athletic director.
Yep.
And then ended up leading the Cowboy Joe Club as well.
Yep.
So I'm gonna ask you, what does an associate athletic director do?
So in my role, and imagine this, you know, I had essentially zero fundraising experience, but I was hired to lead the fundraising efforts on behalf of the University of Wyoming Athletic Department. And that athletic director at the time, his name is Lee Moon. He's now retired from the business, but he and a couple other folks in the athletic department said, you know, maybe this guy can do this. And so they took a complete flyer on me. And at that time, really the focus of our efforts was annual giving. There really wasn't a robust major gift program in athletics at that time. But then had an opportunity to work with somebody who I do consider to be a mentor, who kind of really broadened my horizons in terms of the advancement world, and saw that, okay, now here's how you really, the annual fund was critically important, don't get me wrong, but got exposed to major gift fundraising, and that changed the course of my career.
What stands out? I mean, tell me about why you feel so strongly, whether it was maybe early donor conversations you were involved with, or just maybe understanding the scale of what's possible at that part of the giving pyramid? I mean, what are some of those early reflections?
Yeah, I can recall, and there was a change in the athletic directorship, and a guy by the name of Gary Barta became the athletic director at Wyoming. He had been at the University of Washington. He's quick fast forward. He's gone on to have a great career at the University of Iowa, and just retired in the last year. But we started to work on some projects that the state got behind, facility projects that could really change and have a huge impact on the athletic department and the university. And it was just that experience that I thought, wow, I can make a difference here for my alma mater and the place that I love so much. And I enjoyed working with donors at that level, helping them. And there were a lot of, I used to say there are a lot of comparisons to practicing law, believe it or not, with fundraising at that level. And I always felt like, wow, I'm helping these people make an informed decision about their philanthropy. And that just really, just that's where I kind of found my inspiration.
When you think about visits or relationships, donors, just really poignant memories during that time, anything stand out as just being moments of real pride or maybe huge mistakes? I mean, we learn from the both ends of the spectrum.
Oh, and you touched on too the relationship part of this business that probably when I got involved with it, I certainly didn't have a full appreciation for the business I was getting into, but relationships are a part of it. Whether you're practicing law in a small town, or you're doing major gift fundraising, or you're, the president and founder of Evertrue, relationships are everything. And so just built some wonderful relationships, and I think at that time the university had a history maybe of not thinking big or visionary, and we just were here at a time when we really started that process, I think, when it comes to philanthropy and what we could accomplish. And and of course, that's, it's from there, it's grown many fold. That I can share. I tell you what, I do have one story that I'll share. I recall working with a donor in athletics, and I can't recall the nature of the gift per se, but this particular donor said, "Hey, while I got you on the phone, I'd really like to do something for the College of Health Sciences too." And he said, "Hey, would this?" And at the time we were working with a matching program the state had provided, he said, would those funds apply to the College of Health Sciences too? And I said, "Oh, absolutely. You could create an endowment and make a gift to them. And here's kind of some things you could do, to give the dean flexibility." And I'll never forget, I reached out to the dean of the College of Health Sciences at the time, who later went on to be a university president. And he was astounded that the guy from athletics was calling him, reaching out to him to let him know that I'd secured a gift for his college too.
I mean, and so kind of obvious and so rare in many circumstances. And so I'm curious, when you think about it's such a unique position because you've got a really clear objective. My job is to raise money on behalf of our student athletes to support the what the coaches need and so on and so forth. But the person that I'm talking to has a broad set of experiences and relationships, and there's got to be such a tension between just stay focused, John, stay focused on the task at hand, which is raising money for athletics. Don't go down 100 different rabbit holes around university initiatives. However, that donor might have like really clear opportunities. And you know, in business, you call it the cross sell. How do you cross sell somebody from product A to product B? You know, I'm sure in the legal profession, you start with a simple LLC formation, and then someday you're doing complex estate planning, right? I mean, there's all kinds of examples of cross sell. How have you seen that evolve maybe in the industry or at Wyoming over time?
Oh, I'd like to think that that happens at other universities. I hope it does. I think the larger the university, probably the less likely it happens. I know we've been fortunate here at the University of Wyoming for that to occur with a fair amount of regularity. I remember one of our presidents at the time had the pleasure of working with when I was still in athletics, and he gave me a book, and I still have it, it's entitled On Thinking Institutionally. And I still have a relationship. She's retired, but I have a relationship with him to this day. And I just remember him talking about that, you know, John, you represent the athletics department, but moreover, and most importantly, you represent the University of Wyoming. And that experience and that, you know, influence from a university president, it's something I still use to this day. And when you're making decisions about, you know, think about the donor and their interests, but try to think institutionally and what's good for the institution and not solely maybe the area that a gift officer or development professional might represent. So all kind of pivotal.
Tell me about some of the different roles you've held, ultimately leading development and now leading the foundation overall. Just, I mean, that's a big commitment. You've been really committed. And I think we hear more about, you know, turnover, or, you know, so on and so forth in the sector than just about any other theme. Obviously your story is unique given the deep roots you have developed there. But yeah, I mean, that's been a really rare opportunity, a rare run to have in the sector.
No, it's when our athletic director Gary Barta left to go to Iowa, it created a vacancy, and when they filled that position, they actually hired Tom Berman out of the University of Wyoming Foundation. He had come in as kind of the number two, maybe a year before that, and so when that hire took place, it obviously created an opportunity at the foundation. And at the time, we were a decentralized fundraising model. We had a foundation, but the gift officers were really all located and administered by the deans and were located in the colleges. But we had a centralized function as well. And so that opportunity, the head of the foundation, my predecessor, Ben Blaylock, called me and said, hey, would you ever be interested in looking at kind of broadening your scope of your work and looking at the foundation? And I said, yeah, no, I think I would. I think I really would enjoy considering that move. That I'd enjoyed my 6 years in athletics, but to represent the university and fundraising in a more broad fashion or capacity, I thought, no, I think that would be interesting. So in I pursued that opportunity, ended up getting it, never looked back. I jokingly tell our athletic director, you're better positioned to be an AD and work in athletics. And I'm better positioned to be in the foundation than he was in some respects. And so to this day, we're incredibly fortunate. He and I essentially remain in our respective roles in all these years and have a great working relationship. And that's unique, obviously, in this world. But that's how my foundation relationship started, and that evolved through the years. That's another story. I have stayed with it all these years. Now 17.
I got to ask you just over those years about some of the relationships you've developed around the industry. I saw this great photo pop up a few weeks ago that Matt White shared, and it was you, and it was Ricky McCurry and Tiffany Vickers and Derek Dixon. And it was just so, I was like, man, that is what this industry is all about. And there's many versions of that photo that gets surfaced in, you know, various groups, and you know, just such a unique sector of collaboration and commitment and shared, you know, values in many instances and so forth. Just tell me about that part of this job. And yeah, if there's other, you know, key folks you'd want to mention that you've come to count as peers and mentors along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of those, I mean, that's the wonderful thing about this business is, you know, only in very rare exceptions do we compete for donors. And so our friends and colleagues in the business are always willing to share information and best practices. And certainly AGB was really pivotal in terms of attending the annual leadership forum and building some of those relationships in the industry and try to identify some of those programs and people you admire, perhaps aspire to be like. And so AGB has played a big role in that. And then the Mountain West Conference has always, since my time here, has always had a very collegial group of leaders that would get together, you know, with a lot of regularity. The group we have right now, you just listed some of those names, is a wonderful group. And we just happened to get together here recently on that photo at the Mountain West basketball tournament here in March. And those relationships are critical. Because you're always able to call on your colleagues and share ideas. And sometimes when you're in this position, you need that outside voice and perspective. And you need to look outside your organization, because, you know, we've had a lot of stability here, but in terms of leadership, which has been great, but you also you got to try to diversify those perspectives. And so you do that through your colleagues and mentors in the business.
Yeah. Yeah. And tell me a little bit more about just having been to the university and spent some time in Laramie. Everybody, you know, has their unique culture and so forth, but I feel like you guys have something really distinct. It's hard to describe, you know, sense of community, you know, one big family. And I'm sure there's tension and issues like there are in any family, but it feels like there really is just a strong connection, both, you know, in state, but I'm sure as you travel, you feel that. They say distance makes the heart grow fonder sometimes. And I'm sure you see that on your journeys as well.
Yeah, no, I think we have worked hard to build a a strong organizational culture, and that's certainly a priority, and will be a priority during my time here, certainly in this role, going forward. It's you know, I recall even when I was in athletics here, and I would interact with the foundation folks and the other gift officers regularly. I thought it was important for us to be engaged, very engaged with the university fundraising, even though there was no reporting lines. And I recall it seemed like there was a lot of turnover and fundraisers, and these folks would come through every few years. And I always thought, gosh, who are these folks, you know, that they were part of a campaign at another university, and then they come through and they you know, and then they spend some time here, and then next thing you know, they're off to another institution. And I
sounds like the National Park Service a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit. That's right. Yeah, it's the same thing. But I always thought, gosh, I'm not sure that's ideally how I'd like to. I think some of that's important, but and quite honestly, Laramie being a small town, remote area, when I did get in a position where we were hiring people, we would struggle to attract people with industry experience. And so I thought, you know what? We're in a place like Laramie. Yeah, we need to recruit externally where we can and keep positions, bring in new perspectives, but we also need to have a strong talent development, homegrown, kind of a homegrown mentality in terms of our gift officers, and finding people with a skill set and then giving them the training and the mentoring to succeed. And we've employed that a lot here, and I think we've had a lot of success with it. When you think about, and you know some of the folks, Brent, given your relationship with UW, that we've had so much success with that, and we haven't had as much turnover as some shops see, which I think has been helpful for building the culture, but also building those long-standing relationships with donors. So that's worked well for us. I know there, you know, every place is different, and
those well, are just what stands out is that there is, you know, not exclusively, but there is a lot of homegrown talent on your team.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting in maybe more urban environments, denser communities where maybe a little more transient. Whereas I think there are, you know, many people that like you have, Wyoming is home, it will be home, and the opportunity to grow and develop professionally while also selling and advancing a mission that you've benefited from and believe in deeply. And you see like the intersection between the state and the university and how important it is as the only public institution, you know, in the state. It's all so interconnected in a really unique way. You're both, you know, as big and as small as it sort of gets at the same time, sometimes.
Absolutely. With that comes opportunity. And, you know, we've historically been really well supported by the state, but also with that comes scrutiny, because you are the only four-year institution in the state, I'll take the former over the, I'll suffice to say that, I wouldn't trade our situation. I'll take that scrutiny with the passion and the support that the state has for its only 4-year institution.
And you all have been able, I mean, you have been bold. You have been an amazing partner for us. And this is not an Evertrue specific, you know, conversation, but you all have been able to really help pave the way for thinking bigger and scaling outreach through some of the efforts that, you know, your board has supported that, you know, have for sure made an impact over the last couple of years, but get me really excited about where this industry could be 5 or 10 years from now. And sort of that intersection of like true human to human relationship building. And then obviously, you know, technology and data and systems. You all have really been bold and that's not easy. You know, it'd be a lot easier to do what we did yesterday. And, you know, just curious, when you think about where you see the future heading, what you're excited about, what you're concerned about.
You know, I think, and I appreciate your comments. I think as we were considering to partner with Evertrue and your colleagues, you know, as you think about the uniqueness of our university and the fact that we don't have large metropolitan areas, some would say we don't have metropolitan areas, period. But our donors are, you know, and alumni are scattered all over the country with, you know, pockets where you'd expect to see them, whether it's the Front Range of Colorado. But I still, you know, I thought this as we were considering our partnership with you, and I thought about it, you know, ever since then. And that's like, gosh, if any university's well suited for a program like the DxO program and our Evertrue partnership, it's the University of Wyoming. How you know, to engage that many? We're a small shop. We have been historically, for a number of reasons. How do you reach many more donor, alumni, and friends strategically, but in a meaningful, personal, you know, way? And that's really, it's through the use of technology. And that's why, you know, as I've visited with, as we've presented at AGB, or folks have asked us about our partnership, that's why I said, hey, it's perfect for us, because we're able to engage thousands of more people than we ever would have. We would have hired, how many gift officers would we have, you know, needed to hire to engage that many people? And you know, I'll say, I was just on the phone today with one of our DxOs who closed two major gifts. And I'll share that a little later. But literally drove over the mountain pass between here and Cheyenne to pick up the paperwork on a major gift because he has a relationship with somebody.
Amazing. That's so amazing. There's, you didn't time it that way, but I'll take it.
Yep. That was literally happened this morning. So yeah. How fortuitous. But I'm excited too, because we've got some young new DxO started that I think are going to that bring a lot to the table, that have bright futures in this business. And how, you know, as we go forward, how can data and technology not be a part of our success? Artificial intelligence, it's, you know, it's a lot different than it was when I first started, when I'm poring over, you know, paper lists of donors and making notes on the yellow pad. I mean, that's how I started.
But what's not that different though, John? I don't think what's that different is when you're sitting down with somebody and talking to them.
Nope.
I think it's that different today. And yeah, maybe we're doing it via Zoom sometimes, or we're texting instead of, you know, writing letters. But that is the piece that does feel like it has been the constant. And that is the thing, whether it's your DxO, you know, driving over to Cheyenne, or somebody sitting down on campus, it is the the human-to-human connection, the conversation, is the difference between zero philanthropy, a little bit of philanthropy, and a lot of philanthropy. It's the same institution, the same needs, the same deans, the same students. The difference is, can I connect with you at a personal level? And so when we look at technology, it's such a fine line, because we don't want to over-rotate on the shiny object either. We want to look at the shiny objects and say, how might they help us do that human-to-human thing more, better, faster, more consistently, and eliminate the time we're spending on the yellow notepad?
Yeah. Efficiency. But you're right. Not at the expense of a relationship. We had I was explaining to our president recently, you know, I was in a one-on-one meeting, and I mentioned DXO, and he goes, remind me again what DXO stands for, donor experience officer. And as I was sitting there, I said, you know, President Seidel, you should really come over for a demonstration and meet with our team and see it in action. And so this happened about a month ago, I think. He came over, made an appointment, spent time with Clancy and all the DXOs. He was able to watch how they go about their job. I just watched, you know. I let the DXOs kind of take over, and they took the opportunity to say, okay, President Seidel, let's make a video together. Oh, I'd love that. And so they were able to engage the president, who had maybe just given to a fund that I think benefited the president's fund. And so literally he was making the video and said, hey, I've got somebody special here who wants to say hello today. It's President Seidel. And there's the president joining in. And that was technology, but that was a very personal touch.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, we talk about the potential of scaling presidential outreach. You know, we've always had the list of notes for the president to sign at the end of the month, or, you know, the thing that is sent on behalf of the president by donor relations. And at the same time, you know, 20 seconds on an iPhone video from the president sent via thank you, for example, can be a really amazing experience that wasn't possible 12, 15, 20 years ago. And I think that's where we've got to figure out, okay, if it's that easy, and if it's meaningful to people and it's effective, then how do we scale it? And by the way, if it works well for the president, what about all those deans or the AD or the starting quarterback or whomever it might be that could just make the donors feel even more special, to have a more personalized experience? I mean, we have only scratched the surface, and I'm so glad you just shared that story.
Yeah, he got so enthused that now, I mean, now his chief of staff is like, okay, we got to get training on Evertrue, and we have to have access so that we can utilize it. It was perfect, but it was just, you know, it was, what's, you know, he was curious, what's that DXO stand for again? And I thought, okay, let's get him over here.
I love it. All right. Well, I know we need to wrap here. Tell me a little bit just about the team, the university, what you're excited about right now. What are the coming years, big ideas, things top of mind, you know, as people learn more?
You know, the big thing, and oddly enough, we have not had a comprehensive university campaign in a long time, too long. And so we are in, you know, campaign readiness mode in terms of really assessing our organizational and university readiness. Lots of work with visiting with colleagues around the country, certainly consulting firms about the services that they can provide. And so there's a growing buzz around campus about, it's time. But let's do this right, and let's be really thoughtful. Let's engage the state. You know, again, back to that only four-year institution. You wouldn't want to hear have the governor and the legislature hear read about a campaign in the newspaper or on a blog. You'd want to engage them at the outset. And so that's where we're heading. And we are, I'm excited about, I know it's very fundamental, but we are just dialing in on our students and their success and their outcomes. The students we have and the stories that they can share, they're our best student recruiters. They're our best donor recruiters, our best constituent recruiters. What's central to a student's success? Obviously finding a sense of community, but also a strong faculty that make an impact in their lives. And so I think this story is taking hold, and I know it's so incredibly fundamental and simple, but if we can tell that story, it resonates with everyone and fulfills our land grant mission. And we don't have a great history of faculty support, for example, on our campus, not from a private support standpoint. And that's evolving. We're seeing it happen. And it's motivating others to do the same. And so that's what excites us at the University of Wyoming right now.
I love it. Thank you for sharing. And I would encourage, you know, people to reach out if that resonates. You're on LinkedIn, I know, but, you know, can also easily be found on the website for sure. I guess as we conclude, look, it's April. It's early April right now. We'll try to publish this soon. A bunch of people are planning trips to Wyoming this summer. Some of them are listening. Give us a, you know, off the beaten path, hidden gem or two that they're probably not going to find on the, you know, top 10 list of the blogs.
There are so many hidden gems in them. And, you know, it doesn't, I mean, everybody flocks to the Tetons and Yellowstone, which you should, which Brent Granner, you have to put Jackson Hole. I know you've toured Wyoming and many places in the West. You got to put Jackson Hole on your list. There's some sneaky good places off the beaten path in Wyoming. The Snowy Range, you know, 30 miles from here. What a hidden gem. If anybody's out there listening and they want to some help putting together a summer trip through Wyoming, I would love to help them.
We should probably film a separate podcast
probably could. I mean, complete with, you know, places to have a cold beer or a good breakfast. And, so that is fun. And you've got to stop in and see the University of Wyoming, especially in the summer. It's a beautiful place to visit. And, we love showing people our home. So,
well, I'll tell you what, if you're listening, one of the first things I did when I got to the University of Wyoming for the first time was early one day before our meetings. I think we had an opportunity to meet with the board. I wanted to know what it would feel like to run a sprint at the highest elevation stadium in all of the land, 7,220 feet, if I'm not mistaken. And I'll tell you what, after doing that, I would not recommend you do that on your summer vacation, but you should absolutely stop in Laramie. I don't know how any of these teams come in and actually play four quarters of football at that elevation. I truly don't understand it.
It's fun to see them kind of wilt in the fourth quarter. It's a great equalizer.
That it is. Well, hey, thank you, John. It's really fun to learn more about your story. Appreciate the window into your career, and I would encourage everybody here to reach out. And so with that, I'm going to conclude today's episode with John Stark, who serves as president and CEO of the University of Wyoming Foundation. Thanks, John, and take care, everybody.
Thank you, Brent.